Thank you, Tanya. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRCBC call on the 29th of November 2011. On the call today, we have Michaela Nalen, Kevin Erdman, Barbara Steele, James Bladel, Mike O'Connor, Volker Griman, Philip Corwin, and Simonetta Batiga. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs and myself, Natalie Peregrine, and we have apologies from Jacob Williams and Paul Diaz. I would like to remind you all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie, and welcome. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the IRTPC training call, or working group call for November 29th. I think if you see over here our agenda on the right-hand side of the Adobe chat room, the first item of business is, of course, to ask everyone to ensure that they have submitted a current statement of interest, and if you have no statement of interest or if it's submitted in the old format, please get that remedied as soon as possible. And I think, Marika, I believe that Glenn sent out some reminders for folks who had not done this last week, so we should everyone should know whether or not they have a statement of interest active in the new system. So we'll just go ahead and dive right into the item number two, which is the finalization of our work plan. Now, this was circulated on the list. It was discussed extensively at the last call, and it was posted for review and edits on the list. And, Marika, did we receive any substantial edits to this document since our last call?
This is Marika. No, the only comments or edits were made are the ones that are visible in the document that were made by Avery, and I think I made a couple of few small edits, but we didn't receive any further comments.
Okay. So I think that, you know, as we discussed during our last call, that we would consider this final if there were no substantial comments, and that, of course, we were, you know, it wasn't carved in stone. If we circumstances required that we were to edit it as we went along, that we would do so. Was that someone on the phone? Okay, I thought I heard someone trying to come in. So can we put it to the group, anyone opposed to calling this our final work plan and submitting it to the council as our work plan for this working group, with the understanding, of course, that if we get ourselves into some sort of a bind, that we will edit it as necessary. Looks like we've got a couple of green check marks, so no opposition. Okay, let's call it final, Marika.
Okay.
Excellent. So we can move that to the next. Move on to the next item in the agenda, and I'm not sure how to get out of this document. Looks like someone already did.
Yep, I'm doing that for you.
Thank you. You might want to teach me how to do that someday. Now if we can move over to... Stop sharing, got it. Yes, I do have that button. Okay, so we can move over to item number three. This is the Stakeholder Group and Constituency Statement Input Template and Outreach Plan. I think we had some minor changes to this plan. Oops, where'd it go?
Yeah, I just pulled it down because I just realized I put up the old one. Give me 1 second, and this is the latest one.
Okay, thanks. We had a couple of minor changes to this plan. I think it was the third bullet point and some of the footnote there at the bottom. There was some discussion on the list, I believe, early last week about whether it was registries or registrars that would discuss the use of proprietary registrar identification numbers. And I think that, did we get that clarified in this version, Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. So if you scroll at the end of the document, the last question, I basically incorporated it as Barbara had suggested, and indeed to address the question of registries and registrars, I basically just put both in. I don't know if that's something the working group can agree with, because some suggested it would be more appropriate for registries to respond to this. But I think Barbara originally suggested that registrars might have feedback as well, so maybe the solution would be to just, you know, pose the question to both and see what feedback comes back.
Okay. I'll go ahead and operate through the queue right now. Barbara, you're up first.
Yes, this is Barbara. Thank you. Yeah, I think that that is exactly right. I mean, if we can kind of put it out there, and to the extent that registrars also want to respond to it, I think that's great. We did get some information on the queue. From, I think McKaylee had added some information relative to some of the registries that are he's identified that are currently using proprietary IDs. One of the changes that I would propose that we make to this statement is just in the second line there, change the where it says currently being used by registrars that the use of an ID instead would be preferred beneficial. If we change that, that in that second line to and whether the use of an IDs instead would be preferred or beneficial.
I think okay, I'm sorry, I'm not following. Which where exactly would we want to make that change?
It's in the second line there where it starts information as to where proprietary IDs are currently being used by registrars. Or, I'm sorry, registries.
Yes.
Take that, the that that's right after registries, and change it to and whether the use of INIDs instead would be preferred / beneficial.
Okay. So strike that and add and whether.
Exactly.
Okay. I agree with that. McKaylee, you have a thought on the same subject or something different?
I was just echoing what Barbara was suggesting, that I'm in favor of getting feedback from both registries and registrars.
Okay.
I mean, obviously it impacts, we're the two groups that it impacts. So
yeah.
Obviously what our feelings on it from both groups are is what's most beneficial to anybody.
Wow. Whatever that was, it really hurt. Can we ask folks to use mute this whenever possible? Thanks. So question for McKaylee and for Barbara. It's my understanding that these IDs are pretty much, this is inside baseball for registrants and other parties, that this is not something that they'll encounter or need to know. Is that correct?
No. That's incorrect.
Okay, so this is not just a registrar communication protocol?
Well, it is, but what would happen is that, say, for example, I know that the idea of this now would be just is so strange to you. But if, like, say, imagine if you actually wanted to move your domains to a better registrar than GoDaddy. Deadly silence. Nobody winding up.
I'm listening.
No. If you were transferring domains between registrars, you would be you would have to go to a web page at some point where it would be displayed something along the lines of, we have received a request to transfer the domain from Registrar X to us, or I can't remember the way it's worded off the top of my head. The problem is that the only way you can actually populate the data there is based on the information you have. So if the information coming back isn't consistent or isn't easy to kind of see, all you end up with on some of those pages is you see something like transferring to, and then you have a registrar ID, which is a proprietary thing, or transferring from, and again, the same thing can display. And I've seen this happen with on our system and on several of the other registrars. So it's not just, Black Knight's programmers can't do things, or Enom's programmers can't do it, or GoDaddy's can't do it. It's a thing I've seen on multiple registrars.
So we require this to go to a customer, a registrant?
Yeah. Like, as in the web page you go to, the web page you go to for the FOA stuff to do the click through agreement.
Yeah.
Depending on what way you're set up, you might end up going to it from both the losing registrar and from the gaining registrar, depending on what way things are going, and the information that is displayed there. Like, obviously, if you're the gaining registrar, you know who you are. But you might not know who the losing registrar is because the only information you might be able to access is this proprietary ID in the who is.
Okay.
That's where I've seen it displaying.
Thanks for clarifying.
All right.
Okay, so we have a couple of changes suggested here then. The first one is that we remove the word that in the very last sentence of this document, that we strike the word that, and that we add and whether in place of that, and that was Barbara's change. Do we have any opposition to that? We'll call that. I think that's a much better change, both in terms of meaning and readability. So thank you, Barbara. And then, McKelly, I'm sorry, did you have a specific change, or were you just supporting Barbara's?
I'm being supportive of Barbara.
Okay. Excellent.
Thanks.
Okay, and were there any other suggested changes? Oh, Marika, go ahead.
Hi, sorry for the delay, Eric.
This is Marika. No, there weren't any further changes that were suggested on the list. But one other thing the working group should probably consider is the timeline or the deadline they want to give to constituencies and stakeholder groups to provide their feedback. I think the current bylaws say that it should be 35 days. I think in the new PDP we're saying a minimum of 30 days. But as we're also looking at a holiday period in between, might be something for the group to consider what the deadline should be for stakeholder groups and constituencies to provide this this feedback.
Okay, so we're required a minimum of 30 and the typical of 35. I think that with the holidays we could probably be a little flexible there and offer even 40 days. But I think that anything beyond that would probably start to affect our calendar. Was there anything in the work plan that we want this to coincide with the closing of the comment period, I'm assuming, or as closely thereafter as possible?
This is Rick. I'm just trying to see what we actually have in the work plan. I think I probably assumed 35 days, but from earlier discussions, I mean, of course, it can be staggered a bit because, you know, the working group can start with the public comments it received as part of the public comment period, and once it has finished that go into the constituency statement.
Okay.
Although it might be worth sometimes certain stakeholder groups also tend to submit their comments to the forum, so there might be
an action. Well, 35 days is probably, it seems like it's the norm, and it seems like it would work pretty well. But I have a queue here, so I'll go with Aubrey next. Hi, Aubrey. Thanks for joining.
Oh, hi. Yeah, sorry I was late. In terms of looking at the work plan, we did have it closing on 22 December and then, on 2 January. So I don't know that there would be a big problem if you're sort of saying pushing that an extra week. But that would be a change, too. I don't know if you guys went through the work plan and approved the initial work plan, but it would be the first change to that, which is of course, okay. So the only problem is 2 January realistic if you consider that many people, including ICANN itself, I think, are off from before Christmas until January 2nd, correct? Is ICANN closed that week? Do I remember correctly?
Ms. Marika, yes. We're closed between Christmas and New Year's. That's correct.
Right. So we had the deadline as the first day back. Moving that a week is probably reasonable. And then we could just change the work plan to reflect that.
Okay. So we did accept the work plan, but
this would be the first change. It's a volatile structure.
Yeah. Well, and it wouldn't be a dramatic change, I think, as Marika mentioned, that we could start with the public comments that we would have received during that first week, and then we would probably put these at the bottom of the queue. And, you know, we could also shoot for, because that's, I'm looking at Tuesdays here, and I think the next Tuesday then would be the third. We could look at the closing that, you know, that end of that week, which would be the January 6th week, which would be a Friday, and then that should leave us the meeting of the 10th. I'm wondering if I can pull up the work plan again. We should have all of the constituency statements back by the week of January 10th for that meeting.
Yeah, that would work.
Okay. So, Marika, do we want to put it out there with the 6th? And I see Bob, I think he's agreeing. And Simonette is agreeing as well. So everybody want to just kind of think of us as shooting for January 6th. I think that that's reasonably accommodating given the holiday schedule, but also keeps us pretty close to our work plan.
Okay, I'll change that and I'll update the template and I'll work with Glenn to get that sent out to the different stakeholder groups and constituencies as soon as possible.
Okay, excellent. And does this have to go to council for approval as well, Marika, or can we just put it out there?
This is Marika. I think it's information. I don't think, I'll double check the working group guidelines, but I don't think approval is required. I think it's more information.
Okay, excellent. That then brings us to item number four on the agenda, which is discussing our approach for tackling our charter questions. So this is our first toe in the water of our actual substance of our discussion, is hammering out the approach that we would need to, or charting the path that we would need to tackle these issues. If I can take off any kind of a chair hat and just editorialize for just a second here, it seems like on the surface of it, we have one very straightforward question, which would be item number C. We have one sort of, I don't know if you want to call it a medium question, which is item B, which seems straightforward but might have some tricky considerations that we would have to examine. And I think that item A is the real big one, that we're going to have to probably break that down into smaller working questions. And that may actually even involve some sub-teams to examine specific issues and put those under a microscope. So so that's kind of my just off-the-cuff take on the charter questions. I don't know what necessarily that translates into an approach. So maybe we can start at item C and grab the low-hanging fruit first. And just kind of I'll open the queue here and we can take a discussion on what folks think is a good approach just looking only at question C. And question C reads, whether the process transfers could be streamlined by a requirement for registries to use IANA IDs for registrars rather than proprietary IDs. I see one hand in the queue, and it is Mr. Nalon. Go ahead.
I think we really need to wait on feedback from the registry stakeholder group before we can move any further with that. I think we're going to get comments and feedback from them, but if they turn around and are going to go and throw up their hands and go, oh, this is a terrible idea, or they go, oh, this is fine, this is easy, I mean, that's obviously going to dictate what we can and can't do.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, again, we're just discussing the approach here, so that's a good approach, just to first get some feedback from registries.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, James, I mean, that one I think is it's going to be very, very binary in that if the registries kind of say no, and presuming they actually provide a reason for the no, apart from no, we don't want like the idea without explaining it, then that's pretty much it. But we can't really do much until then. For B, I'd like to get personally I'd like to get input from SAC on that and to see, and maybe APWG.
I'm sorry,
or
wait.
Something.
Did you move on to B?
Yeah. Sorry, I went from
okay.
B to C to B.
Okay, well, we just wanted to kind of make sure we got all the stuff buttoned up for C, I guess, first. So.
Okay. Well, for C anyway, that's my way of viewing it. I'll
okay.
Shut up now.
Any other thoughts on C? On C?
C? Charlie. On
Charlie.
Oh, sorry. No. Oh, sorry. It was me. Shut myself up.
I want to just go ahead and put myself in the queue. I agree with you, McKelly. I think that we need to get some feedback from the registries on exactly how extensive this is and why why it's important to leave it. We need to judge the status quo versus the perceived benefits that we would have from changing it to IANA IDs. And I don't think we fully understand both sides of that equation yet. We also need to understand that for those registries that are using proprietary IDs, is there a security issue involved? Is it? I don't know that we've ever had anyone spoof a registrar in communications to a registry, or if that's even possible. Because of all the security measures that are in place. But, I mean, I suppose it's nothing is foolproof, so that's one consideration. So I guess I would like to understand their justification and the pain that would be involved in changing it, and then the benefits that it would be for registrars and others to streamline the process. And a lot of those things, I think, will come out of the feedback from the stakeholder groups and constituencies. Hi, Simonetta. You're up.
I have a question on that one. I'm wondering if when we are sending our request for input to the registry stakeholder group on that particular point, should we then ask them for reasons why they would not want to have this done in case they are opposed to it, so that we make sure that they actually give us the reason rather than just saying, no, we don't like it? Or maybe give an explanation for why they set up something other than the IANA IDs in the first place, so you get a better understanding for what, where they're coming from.
Okay. We might just take a look at that. I think that we left the language fairly open-ended, but we can certainly take a look at that and whether we need to insert just a quick phrase into that last section of, you know, say, you know, explain whether or not you do this and then and why you think it's important. And just kind of lead them, lead the answers to this idea that, you know, things should be justified as opposed to left open-ended. Barbara?
Hi, this is Barbara. Yes, just to follow on to Simonetta's concerns, I've already sent out kind of a list of questions to the registry stakeholder group members to just get them to start thinking about this. And so I've made some notes here as well just to make sure that we get details surrounding, you know, why they're not being used and what the level of effort is to try to put them in place where they're not currently being used, things like that. So I will definitely, in the response back and the statement for the registry stakeholder group, make sure that I provide as much detail as possible.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. So in your opinion, since you're kind of representing that entire stakeholder group that we're asking this information of, do you think that the constituency input template needs to be changed, or are you just going to make sure that they include some justification?
I think that we can go ahead and leave it as is. I mean, if we want to put some additional language in there, that's fine, just to make sure that it's clear. And if we're anticipating, I think that it's going to be most important to get that feedback from the registries, because they're the ones that are going to be impacted with whatever development costs would be associated with it. Now, there could be also some impacts to registrars who are currently using the information that's provided. I think it could simplify their situation, but there may also need to be some adjustments on their end. So maybe we go ahead and put some additional information or, you know, requests in here. Anyone else have any thoughts?
I'm fine with that either way. I think that if you're going to shepherd their responses, then I think we can rely on you to make sure that they don't leave us hanging and give us opinions without justifying them.
Can I get any feedback from, I guess, the registrars that are currently on the call to say whether or not making a change from proprietary to the IANA IDs would impact them from a development standpoint?
I'll let Michele go, and then I'll put myself in the queue behind him. Go ahead, Michele.
It probably would have an impact, but I would see it as a positive one as opposed to a negative one. I mean, from our perspective, anything where stuff is standardized, it means my programmers don't have to go off and write extra code to, you know, make intelligent guesses. So, I mean, probably it might have some impact, but if so, I wouldn't see it as being negative. Because, I mean, the IANA IDs is available as an XML download, for Christ's sake. So, you know, if I was able to match one against the other, I could do all sorts of funky things and make my life easier.
Right, so the benefit would outweigh any development costs that you may have.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely from our perspective. I can't speak for other registrars, but from my own personal perspective, I wouldn't see it as an issue. I mean, I can see Rob's agreeing. Actually, both Robs are agreeing. I mean, one is saying it only take him a minute. I don't know how long it would take the other one. But, you know, I'm sure James will probably say now that it might say something slightly different. But from our perspective, I don't see it as an issue.
Yeah, I'll say not a minute, probably take a little bit longer than that to get everywhere that touches. But I think it would be a good investment of time and development resources because of the simplicity and the reduction of issues that it's going to create down the road. So I want to echo a lot of what Michele is saying.
Actually, do you mind if I just come back very quickly, James?
Yeah, go ahead, Michele.
Just one thing just to bear in mind, I mean, and this is part of the reason why I'm pushing a lot for the kind of standardization stuff, is that if there's going to be potentially hundreds of registries in the future, and in a not too distant future, then fixing this kind of problem now should remove a lot of headaches in the future. Because, I mean, it might be one thing if there's 900-odd registrars now and only a dozen or so registries that you can kind of reverse engineer something, but that doesn't scale when the number of registries suddenly goes up to 500 or 1,000.
Agreed. Rob?
Can I see only see plus points for getting them to do it? It would make transfers an awful lot easier if we knew sometimes who they were coming from. That's not always possible with things like .info because of the proprietary numbering system. When we built our system, we set it all up based on configuration files. From our point of view, there's only one place our number for .org is ever mentioned. So there are other places, I'm sure, where it's been put into people's code at various points and may take some registrars longer to find an update. But I can't see any downsides to doing it at all.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. And that reminds me, we even had an incident, I think, a few months back where a small registrar was, we were trying to get an FOA, and we were using a proprietary ID, but their name had changed. And since we didn't update our existing database, we were calling them by this older name. Whereas an IAN ID, we could just reference the current list from ICANN, and I think that we would mostly eliminate that issue. So I think those are good points, and I think that the benefits probably outweigh whatever development efforts would be required. So does that answer your question, Barbara, at least amongst the registrars that are on this call?
Great, thank you. I appreciate the feedback. I think given that, we probably can go ahead and just leave it as is, and I'll just make certain that I solicit the feedback that's going to answer those questions as to why not, if there is any pushback.
Okay, appreciate that. Excellent.
Sure thing.
Okay, well, the queue is clear, so maybe let's take a look at charter question B. This is a discussion of time-limiting the FOAs. And I think that there's some interesting considerations here, both from transfers perspective, I think from aftermarket's perspective, so we're looking for Bob and Simonetto to weigh in as well, and possibly from a security perspective. So, Michele, you had a thought on there, so I'll invite you to raise your hand, but looks like you're a little slow on the draw, so we'll go with Mr. Mountain first. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks, James. This is Bob Mountain speaking. I guess, James, I had a question. Is the text here where it's saying that it's implying that the time would be limited in the case where the name was locked, is that just an example, or is that the definitive use case that we're concerned about here?
You know, my understanding, Bob, and I would definitely ask others to weigh in, was that was just one possible scenario where this would come into play. My understanding was just in the general abstract case, does the FOA have an expiration date? And maybe that's something that we need to address that question first. But I don't know if that answers your question. I took it as more of just a specific example of a general issue.
Yeah, okay, thanks, James. That was my assumption, but I just wanted to, first of all, clarify that. I guess I'll, you know, from an aftermarket standpoint, I'll just state that I would be concerned about time limiting an FOA in that, you know, domain owners with domains to sell, large or small, generally intend for them to sell, and time limiting an FOA would impose an extra step maintenance that they would need to, conduct that they don't have to today. Most of these people, when they want to sell a domain, they list it for sale and it stays there until they sell it. So I would want to go on record as being somewhat concerned about the extra work that something like this might impose on a domain owner who is looking to sell their domain. That's all.
Okay, well, I have a couple of questions on that, and I generally would just like to understand that process a little bit better. So if you don't mind, maybe McKelly and Simonetta can weigh in as well. So the question is, does the current FOA have any time constraints at all, or is it once you've given the authorization, it's there in, you know, forever? Is that a correct assumption, or
is that per policy, James, or in practice?
Well, let's start with policy, and then let's go to, I mean, you know, we don't have to solve this issue today. We're still kind of just hammering out the approach, right? So I think that's the first question we need to understand is what are the practices and what does the policy say?
It's McKaylee. James, as far as I'm aware, and this is why this question ended up on within our charter, to the best of my knowledge, there is no reference to a timeout in the current policy.
Okay. Thanks, McKelly. And so, you know, I think that, you know, some other registrars may say, well, you know, we have a short time period, and others might say, well, we'll treat it indefinitely, and others might say, well, it's especially an aftermarket registrar might say, well, your listing is only paid for 30 days, so your FOA is only good for 30 days or something along those lines. So, Bob and Simonetta, is your experience that registrars implement this differently? It's all over the map, or?
Yeah, my understanding is that it's not clear in the policy statement. I would agree with McKaylee. I guess that's our position as well, and that the sort of indefinite nature of the FOA is certainly a very, you know, appropriate way from an aftermarket standpoint to handle it.
Okay. Go ahead now with McKaylee.
Okay, Bob, you know I love you to death. You are one of the sweetest, nicest guys I know.
Uh-oh.
But I have to violently disagree with you on this, violently. I mean, realistically speaking, domain name policy should be set up so that it serves all registrants and all users. Mm-hmm. And while I can appreciate that making a change here might involve a little bit of extra work for you and for your clients, sorry, but you know they're only a small number of the registrants. I mean, the fear I have with the current setup is that it is open to abuse. So, let's say that James and I, we both have a domain name registered with GoDaddy, and James sells the domain to me. But prior to the domain changing between accounts within GoDaddy, James had already unlocked the domain and had started a transfer to, say, pool.com or one of their registrars. So under the current policy, then that FOA with Pool is still open, even though the registrant has now changed hands. I mean, there is an inherent danger there. The other side to it as well is that from an aftermarket perspective, surely the security of a high value asset such as a domain name would outweigh any little bit of extra work that some of them would have to do. I mean, if a domain is changing hands for $100,000 or $200,000, surely refreshing the FOA every X number of days wouldn't be that cumbersome.
May I reply, James?
Can I just jump in real quickly here? And then, yes, I will go to Bob for a response before we go to Simonetta. But just real quickly, I just want to ask folks to please, you know, try to resist the temptation to dive into the actual substance of the issue. We're just discussing the approach here. What sort of questions do we need to gather? What information are we missing? You know, what sort of dependencies are we trying to uncover? So before we debate the actual nuts and bolts of the issue, let's make sure we have our approach nailed down. I know that's kind of a fuzzy line that is very easy to cross, but I would ask that folks just keep that in mind. So I'll go to Bob for a response, and then Simonetta right after that. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so this is Bob. My apologies for diving in. I've done exactly that. But McKaylee, I am not opposed to an FOA indefinite without conditions. I think under the appropriate conditions that the FOA could then, become inactive or invalid. So I'm not disagreeing with you on that at all. I think it's a matter of what those conditions are and what's involved. So.
Okay, Simonetta? And then I have a question as well. I'll go after Simonette. Go ahead, Simonette.
Well, I have two items. You asked whether or not from an aftermarket point of view and what the current policies and practices are. So in terms of, there is nothing in the policy, so we definitely know that there is folks out there, including some of our own products, that take advantage of the fact that FOAs don't expire. It's something that facilitates trading in the aftermarket world, and it's not just amongst domainers. It is also giving the opportunity to end users all around the world to have access to names for their websites that they would like to purchase anywhere. So it's part of this is something that enables an easy transfer that way is the fact that there currently are no limitations on around those FOAs. So in terms of our approach, and that was your second question, I think it would be important for us to understand what's currently being done and why, what it enables, what would the implications be if you put restrictions, what are the reasons why you want restrictions, what are the use cases for that, so that when you know that, okay, Michaela, for example, brought up this concern that if a domain changes hands from registrant A to B within the same registrar, yet an FOA with an external party might still be open. Well, I don't think anyone would have a problem with the fact that an FOA expires the moment the registrant record updates, for example. So I think it would be important for us as an approach to understand what are those reasons for why we're even looking at this question, what are those security concerns, can they be addressed in some way, shape, or form with a policy around the FOAs that kind of says, okay, if this and that happens, then the FOA expires. In all other cases, if it can stay active, or if it's something like that possible. And so I think we need to understand what the concerns are, and we need to also understand what the use cases are of what's currently being done, because the FOA does not have an expiration date on it, and then weigh what would we limit if we change the rules, and what can we maybe do if we make a rule that isn't a blanket rule for everything but has certain use cases in mind. It's just an idea from my point of view on the approach. And then obviously on that charter question, we should look at the input we're getting from the public comments period, and obviously when reaching out to registrars, and if we can find a way on the charter question to reach those folks who actually actively trade domain names, they're not really represented in this work group very well, and outside of Bob and myself, who kind of, I don't even trade names myself, I just help people trade names on our system, but I think it would be very interesting to get some feedback from domainers and other people who sell and trade and hold large domain portfolios to get their input and thoughts and concerns around this FOA idea.
Okay, thanks, Simonetta. I have one follow-up to your statement, and then I have a couple of questions of my own. So the follow-up would be, would you and Bob be willing to, at least seek out some of those large portfolio holders and direct them to the public comment period so that we can get their
certainly.
Feedback and get it into the record? Because I agree with you, that's a segment of the community that isn't always participating in ICANN discussions. I'm sure it's not sexy enough for what they want to do. So, maybe if we can actively steer them towards the comment periods, we can get their thoughts as well. So I had just a couple of quick thoughts here. One would be, for the approach, I think that we need to, we're back to the traditional portability versus security discussion, or are we? We need to understand how the policy, if the policy currently does not time limit the FOA, we need to understand how that's beneficial to not just the aftermarket, I think that's a specific use case, but just in general how that's beneficial to streamlining the transfer process. And then we can understand as well what risks that might present. And if there's a way to address those risks without having a negative impact on the aftermarket community. So, for example, if there was a time limit, but it was a specifically long time limit, like 90 days or something like that, you know, it seems like that would possibly address a lot of the, or some, or most of the security issues, you know, with while still being flexible enough. You know, I don't know. I'm just throwing some ideas out there about why we would need to gather input from all areas and then just try to balance all of those different needs. One question I had for the aftermarket folks, because I don't really understand how these multi-registrar networks all operate, but if you were to have, let's say, a standing FOA where I wanted to list a name for sale and I pre-authorized an FOA, doesn't the FOA specifically limit the transfer to one registrar? Meaning, for example, if there's a network or a syndicate of registrars all participating in a particular aftermarket, and I use I put my FOA out there to pre-authorize the transfer, doesn't that mean that it has to go only to registrar X in the syndicate and not some of the other participating registrars? So that's one question. I see Bob's got his hand up, but I wanted to put one other question out there, which was, is this question at all dependent upon what we come up with question A? Because right now I think that question B and the discussion of the FOA is somewhat dependent upon using registrar or the IRTP as a change of control. And, you know, if there is some sort of outcome of question A that challenges the idea of a change of control or introduces a new process, does this become a moot point? So those are just some of the questions I think that we might want to include in our approach. And I see that I have shaken the tree sufficiently here to generate a queue. So I'll start with Bob. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, James. This is Bob speaking. I guess our terms of service are that the FOA applies to members of the reseller network, which would include, you know, many registrars. So the pre-authorization or the pre-FOA then applies to, you know, whatever registrar is part of the network and is the destination. So that's, you know, certainly our implementation of it. So, yeah, I guess that's the answer to your question, A. Your second question, James, I don't know. I can't comment on that. I would defer to someone else in the queue on that one.
Okay, thanks, Bob. McKelly?
Oh, sorry, I had myself on mute. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if there's no way for, at the moment, there's no way to for anybody beyond a registrar's internal systems to trigger anything with regard to a change of registrant in a thin registry. And more importantly, the FOA resides with the gaining registrar, not the losing registrar. So how can you inform the gaining registrar that the FOA that they have has now been nullified? I mean, there is no way to do that I'm aware of. I mean, technically, you can't send an EPP message down a queue from a registrar to another registrar just like that. I mean, there's no mechanism for that. So I suppose in some respects, if you want to look at doing things down in that particular fashion, then there's no way to do that unless you handle the change of control in charter question A.
Yeah, that's a good point, McKelly. And then looking at it from the other side, suppose I have an FOA for a sale I'm really excited about and the deal falls through. How do I cancel an FOA if they have an indefinite lifespan? How do I take it back? And, you know, maybe this is a question that we'll need to understand in our approach is if an FOA is immortal, what events or actions can trigger it to be rescinded or is that even a security concern? And maybe that's a question that we need to understand as well, is that has anyone ever lost a domain name due to an FOA being out there that they had forgotten about? Is the aftermarket the only group that this even really applies to? I mean, these are questions I think that definitely constitute part of our approach. Simonetta?
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with saying that A and B really tie together in that regard, because at the FOA, as is my understanding, is kind of like an extension of the IRTP, which only had in mind the use case of a domain transfer from one registrar to another while the owner wouldn't change at the same time. In that case, if the thing never expires, it's completely irrelevant, because the only person who would ever really have to use this is one registrant. Now, when you're bringing the second person in the mix, where you have a seller and a buyer and you have two registrants really that kind of are on either side of this domain transfer, you're really faced with this FOA that for that particular use case, even today, makes no sense whatsoever. So I don't think it really makes that much sense to look at B from an aftermarket point of view without having an idea for how to tackle A.
Okay, good point. Thank you. Well, we have about 9 minutes left, and we can take a look at A. I think that is the, as we mentioned earlier, that is the big one. That's the gorilla in the room when it comes to this particular working group. Which, a little background for folks who weren't in IRTPB, and how this came to be, this question came to be part of our charter. We discovered that there is no, I want to say, prescribed ICANN-approved policy that says this is how you transact or change the control of a domain name from one registrant to another. And I think that in the absence of something formal like that, a number of conventions and, if we want to call it ad hoc or, if we can call it innovative market-based solutions have sprung up. And they have their benefits and that they have their drawbacks as well. But I think that all of them make some use, or most of them make some use of the transfer policy or overlap somewhat with the transfer policy. So our approach here would be to, first, I think, understand, in my opinion, would be first to understand, was this, is this truly a hole that needs to be filled in the policy patchwork? And if so, how do we begin to understand all of the different elements? I think that this is aimed squarely at the aftermarket, but I suppose it could also be aimed, I'm thinking abstractly here. I'm thinking that when you are enforcing a UDRP decision, for example, and taking a domain name from Party A and assigning that registration to Party B, sometimes that also uses the transfer. And, would that be better served by a more formal process? So, that's just kind of, I think, my initial off-the-cuff thinking for item A. I think it's a big question. I think it's going to require us to unpack a lot of the different issues there, and I think that's going to consume, honestly, I think it will probably consume about 50% of our discussion time will be on question A. So we have a few minutes there. If anyone wants to weigh in, not on the issue itself, but on the approach of how we begin to untangle that issue, and then I want to make sure that we give about 5 minutes break between this call, the formal PDP call, and then the next one-hour session, which is IRTP training. So any thoughts on what we need to take into account when we start to unpack question A? Mikey.
Hi, James. It's Mikey. I'm sort of taking notes in my little mind manager gizmo, and wanted to see if we could sort of do parallel approaches. For item B, the discussion we just had, there were sort of three big blobs that we talked about. One was sort of the first one, understand why we're looking at the question, what problems we're trying to solve. Then there was a pretty extensive discussion about identifying use cases and scenarios of both current practices and current policy. And then there was another big discussion about understanding issues and concerns, big long list for both those last two. In a way, we could probably parallel an approach pretty much along those same lines for item A and get at least fairly close to a way to unpack it. So that's just the thought that's emerged from the little notes that I've been taking.
Mikey, I think that's a sound approach. Can I put you on the hook to maybe put 5 or 6 questions for item A and item B and circulate that on the list?
This is Mikey again. I'd be happy to just sort of tidy up these notes and circulate that. I think it's easier to follow if I leave it in this framework. And if Marika, you want to make me a presenter, I can show you what's on my screen right now and see what you think. And then if you think this is useful, I can just push this out to the list.
Well, I'm saying the list only because, and I probably shouldn't have opened this this topic so close to the end of the call, but
James, in order to finesse the, I don't really want to develop a series of questions, but what I could do is push the stuff that I've got so far, and we could just pick this up again on the next call.
That would be perfect.
Using that as a hint.
Yeah,
okay.
That would be it.
I can do that.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
Aubrey, you're next in the queue, or, oh, nope, that's changing to a green. Okay, so we've reached the, oops, Samantha, go ahead.
I think in terms of approach here, also, we should encourage maybe those registries who have a change of control function in their policies to share with us some of the learnings and thoughts that went into why they did theirs the way they did it. And I wonder if we could find a few people who have dealt with it on the receiving end, basically, who made use of that change of control function to give us specific feedback on that one as well. So I'm trying to figure out, maybe I can reach out into our transfer team to kind of like pull up a few cases where some of these CCTLDs have traded and actually reach out to the buyers and sellers relating to that transfer to get some of their feedback and maybe even also get some feedback out of our transfer team who basically work with those transfers every single day to see what they are telling me they like and dislike and what works and doesn't work in that space.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have reached the top of the hour. And the queue is clear, so let's go ahead and just saw off our discussions for there. I think that for next time, we will probably have a continued discussion of our approach on these particular questions. Just wanted to remind folks that there is now a training session that will be beginning here shortly in the same area, but you will have to disconnect and recall this number, the password. Marika, if you want to give that, are we clear to give that in this forum?
Yes.
Okay. So the password is training, and then you would use that to connect to the IRPT training session. Same Adobe link, same telephone number, just a different password, and we'll start that here probably in a minute or two, and then we'll give everyone just a couple of minutes to assemble. So thanks for your help, everyone. I appreciate the rapid pace that we're getting through some of these agenda items, and we'll make sure that we keep feeding aggressive agendas to this group because I think that I can tell that everyone likes to keep this pace and preserve this momentum, and I think it's going well so far.
Thank you, James.
Goodbye.
Okay. Thanks,
thank
everyone.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks.